the thanks that we already owe the Middle East Forum and to our precious host for recognizing the significance of our work and inviting us to present it at this distinguished gathering, were redoubled a week ago by the column that Dr. Pipes devoted to our book. The immense impact it immediately registered only confirmed the prestige that he and the forum enjoyed, which makes our appearance here so much greater a privilege. Our heartfelt thanks also to all the Jewish organizations that took part in this event, and our special gratitude is to Dr. Judith Klinghoffer, who brought us and forum together. This is especially the case because our research has produced, against our own expectations, a challenge to the predominant views in Israel, the United States, and the West regarding the genesis and conduct of an event that has shaped subsequent history in the Middle East. Although the Six-Day War's consequences have been universally appreciated, its own character and origins, as we discovered, remained largely mysterious, and to the extent that ever explained, a major, if not dominant, factor was excluded or minimized. The crisis of May 1967 and the war that it sparked have been portrayed as primarily a local conflict in which the parties were backed but also restrained in a fairly symmetrical way by their superpower patterns, the rival principles in the Cold War. While the United States and Soviet Union jockeyed for advantage in various arenas, they made sure not to let these frictions unleash a direct clash between them that might touch off a nuclear cataclysm. Moscow, as much as Washington, it was believed, certainly didn't initiate all-out war between their regional clients, which might suck the superpowers in. It was this basic assumption that we gradually found ourselves disputing on the basis of evidence that was hitherto unknown or disregarded. We had no premonition, let alone intent, of assuming this role of historical revisionist. In the course of our journalistic work in 1999, a routine scan of media from the former Soviet Union turned up a curious item of more than topical interest. In the Ukrainian daily, a former Soviet naval officer related how, on the first day of the Six-Day War in June 67, on board of frigate in the Eastern Mediterranean, he was ordered to prepare and lead a 30-man so-called volunteer force for landing on the Israeli coast. And you may have seen him in a documentary 2 days ago on the PBS. He went on to describe how the operation was repeatedly postponed until on the war's last day it was activated, only to be aborted when the ship was within 20 miles of its assigned beachhead, Haifa port. Our disbelief grew as we consulted the authoritative historical works on the period. Virtually all accepted wisdom held that although the Soviet Union did trigger the crisis by making false accusations that Israel was massing troops to attack Syria, Moscow then acted to contain the conflict and to prevent war. When hostilities did break out, the USSR cooperated with the United States to end them. The conventional narrative held that the Soviet leadership, scarred by its setback in the Cuban Missile Adventure and moving towards detente, had by 1967 evolved a cautious and responsible foreign policy. Although it was still competing with Washington for influence worldwide, excuse me, and in the Middle East, risking a head-on clash between the nuclear superpowers was out of the question, no matter how high the regional stakes. I reiterate this point because in retrospect, even at the time, this concept was mostly based, for lack of other evidence, from the Soviet side on official declarations and press material, in other words, propaganda. Moreover, it disregarded those well-known occasions when the sensible rules of the game were rudely violated. Sorry, this is the New York weather and downpour 2 days ago. Cuba before the Six-Day War, Afghanistan afterwards, and of course, in the same arena, the War of Attrition and the Yom Kippur War. What we discovered to have been a major plan by the Soviet Union to upset the supposed stability of the Cold War world, which turned on the classically global issue of nuclear proliferation and involved a calculated but substantial risk of global confrontation, remained unaccounted for merely because it foundered. It left but few tracks, which could quite easily be covered up by the Soviet and Arab side, especially as the U.S. and Israeli side quite willingly cooperated in this blackout for their own considerations. The accessibility of Soviet archives, despite the myth that they have been opened, has hardly changed. Even before its increasing reversal under Putin, this opening was in the main a selective and often random outcome of disorder and corruption. It is not that nothing valuably emerged from these archives, a lot did, but such crucially important resources as the records of the Politburo or the General Staff, not to mention KGB or GRU, were never systematically released and are unlikely to be anytime soon, if ever. Moreover, as we demonstrate in our book, even if and when they are obtained, such documents may well have been designed to conceal or distort the actual decisions and policy rather than to reflect them. Therefore, they must be treated as cautiously as other types of evidence. And it increasingly appears that in many cases, no paper trail was left at all, or it was destroyed after being created. In brief, the kind of criticism that is now being leveled at our findings, namely, that the critics found no basis for them in Soviet archives, is not only fallacious. It is only disturbingly dangerous, because it implicitly admits the Orwellian nightmare, whereby the absence, prosecution, or suppression of archival evidence can and should be allowed to excise entire chapters from history. If we can't show the record on official letterheads, the event never happened. Given the present-day tendencies in America regarding secrecy, this concern hardly pertains to autocratic regimes alone. Of course, it doesn't mean that the lack of official documentation constitutes proof positive and anything did occur. The burden of proof still rests on us. But it means, to paraphrase a somewhat unpopular figure in Washington these days, we can only go to war with the army we have, not the one we would like to have. Our book highlights several astounding and revealing examples of officially published documents that almost certainly were released only out of error, ignorance, carelessness, or field security lapses. Other papers, such as the critically important speech that Brezhnev made before the Central Committee on 20th June 67 to set out the party line of the war, were never published in Moscow, but came to light in other capitals in the former Warsaw Pact. But as the Talmud warns, one cannot depend on such miracles. Fortunately, we also could fall back on another massive army in the form of a vast literature, which was produced by the combination of economic hardship and political disruption just before and just after the fall of the USSR. While it too must be handled with extreme care, it is extensive enough to offer numerous mutually corroborating versions from unrelated sources that can also be checked against Western Israeli versions, archival and other. And for the most part, the Soviet literature of veterans and other participants' memoirs, publications and research is no more suspect of vested interest bias than the memoirs of Western Israeli and Arab actors that have long populated the footnotes of conventional scholarship. What these constraints do dictate is a departure from the practice of formulating a grand theory of a Soviet doctrine and then imposing it as a touchstone for testing the veracity of factual reports. What we attempted was the opposite, to assemble as many as we could of such factual components into a picture of what the USSR actually did. If this picture doesn't conform with the theoretical concept, we leave it to the greater mind to reassess the concept. And after this long introduction, I will try to encapsulate these factual findings of ours, and then let Gideon take over with one detailed example that also explains our book's title. The initial account provided by our naval officer, whom we found to be absolutely reliable and respectable, turned out to be the tip of an iceberg. His unbelievable story of a landing operation in Israel, that was begun but aborted, was backed up by similar versions from several other ships, by military interpreters who were put on alert to serve as the landing forces liaison with Israeli Arabs, by a Moscow official at the time who confirmed that such an order was indeed given, by the TASS Middle East correspondent at the time, who added that the operation also included regular Marines, and even by the commander of one such Marine unit, who was himself wounded when his outfit actually landed, but was crippled by an Israeli air attack. The single explicit evidence to date of a direct Soviet-Israeli clash in 1967. No wonder his story vanished from the website of the Belarusian Defense Ministry after we tried to contact him for more details. In Minsk, as well as in Moscow, the cover-up continues. This entire landing operation, in turn, was but one aspect of a much more comprehensive plan. In brief, our book asserts, and we think it proves, that the Soviet Union, starting at the latest in mid-1966, elaborated with Egypt and Syria a detailed plan for precipitating the crisis. Upon the agreed signal and pretext of a false Soviet warning about Israeli troop concentrations on the Syrian border, which was hitherto mistakenly considered as intentional disinformation of the Arab side, Egypt was to initiate provocative measures that Israel would have to regard as a casus belli. This was aimed at provoking Israel into a preemptive strike, which would then legitimize a direct military intervention by the USSR in favor of its clients when Israel was internationally branded as the aggressor. In the Soviet estimates, if Israel and its Arab neighbors were allowed to fight it out on their own, they would reach a stalemate. Even a limited Soviet intervention might thus tip the balance against Israel. In addition to the naval element just described, it was to include, among other components, an attack by strategic bombers and fighter aircraft cover both for the bombers and for our forces. While the USSR did not actively seek a superpower clash, it was prepared to assume some risk by probing the envelope. It assumed that the United States would be less likely to respond in kind if the Israelis struck first, and certainly if the Soviet prime motive and target was Israel's nuclear program, which was our latest and most dramatic discovery. It also must be stressed that in hindsight, there is a tendency to attribute to the United States in 1967 the same commitment to Israel that developed in later years. In fact, the superpower-client relationship in the Middle East was decidedly asymmetric. After the initial naval clue led us to assemble a mass of evidence for the Soviet-Arab plan and its actual activation, detractors of our thesis had a cogent objection. They had a fairly impressive list of Soviet war aims at the regional level. They included a defeat of Israel by the USSR's Arab clients that would strengthen both their own regional standing and their dependence on Moscow, while undermining the regime's alliance with Israel's supposed supporter, the United States. Control could be established over Middle Eastern oil outlets, thus increasing Soviet leverage on Western Europe. But our critics correctly protested that any of all these regional war aims were out of all proportion to the enormous risk that the plan entailed, up to a nuclear clash, the gamble referred to in our book's subtitle. There was some indication that the added ostensibly irrational factor was plain old-fashioned anti-Semitism. In the book, we trace the continuity of anti-Jewish incitement and persecution in Russia from Tsarist through communist times and its complex interplay with Moscow's policy towards Israeli statehood. By 1967, the end has long since come for the brief honeymoon that resulted from Soviet illusions about this. Thank you. By 1967, the end has long since come for the brief honeymoon that resulted from Soviet illusions about a socialist Jewish satellite on the warm water of the Mediterranean. This honeymoon had rapidly given way to hostility dictated by Cold War interests. But the USSR was still formally committed to its recognition of Israel, and at most could state as an official policy goal the reduction of the Jewish state to the unviable borders that it was assigned by the 1947 partition plan, which Moscow had endorsed. Still, there was in the Soviet palace of the time a subtext calling for Israel's total elimination as a war goal or projected for result in 1967. Soviet diplomats in various capitals predicted or threatened that the impending war would leave no remnant of Israel. In two testimonies we received after completing the book, Israeli communist leaders were reassured that Soviet forces would be there to protect them, by implication to rescue them from the fate that was about to befall other Israelis. Here I can add my own personal recollection. When I had to turn in my Komsomol card ahead of departure for Israel in late 1966, I was told by the organization's chief in my hometown, Chernobyl, that, quote, "You are a traitor. There is going to be a war, and I will volunteer to fight for Egypt, and I will kill you." Unquote. Such sentiment at the local level undoubtedly reflected signals from at least part of the leadership. Defense Minister Andrei Grechko, for instance, is reported to have issued an order of the day to the Soviet Officers' Corps, promising that the jubilee year of the Bolshevik Revolution would be the last year of the Zionist state. The physically imposing Grechko is described as prone to violent gesticulation, and he declared his determination to wipe out imperialism and Zionism, which is hardly surprising given his useful service in the Civil War's Red Cavalry, led by the murderous pogromshik Semyon Budyonny. Happily, it is now anyone's guess whether, had the Soviet Arab plan been played out in 1967, the USSR, against its own interest and declared policy, would have cooperated or acquiesced with its Arab client's declared aim of eradicating Israel. But we found no basis to conclude that it was this anti-Semitic undercurrent which forced the USSR to assume an otherwise outsized risk. We believe that this proportionality objection has been answered by identifying one of the Soviet's main motives, if not the main motive, and certainly the factor that determined the timing: preventing Israel's attainment of nuclear weapons. It is no coincidence, then, that one keyword of our title is Dimona, the location of Israel's main nuclear facility. I will now give floor to Gideon to account for the other keyword, Volpe.
Well, first of all, I have to make a few apologies, and the first is for the state of both our voices, as you heard, it's due mainly to New York weather. Now, I'll go on to the first person singular, because although I wholeheartedly endorse Isabella's thanks to our host, I must add a note in which I speak only for myself. Anyone in the audience, and there are some, who knows me from Israel must be wondering, what is this veteran merits voter, peace now demonstrator, and in U.S. terms liberal Democrat, doing of all places at an event even partly sponsored by the Middle East Forum? Well, I have not changed my views on present-day politics either here or there, but I would be honored to engage a forum of such intellectual integrity and caliber, even in debate, and what is more important, on the results of our research, even that should not be the case. Our historical inquiry has no present-day political agenda, if only because Isabella's views and my own are far from identical. But one thing that I do believe we have helped to establish incontrovertibly is that Israel did not initiate the Six-Day War, which it has been repeatedly accused of doing for expansionist purposes. This conclusion ought to be welcomed to the entire Zionist spectrum, regardless of its opinion as to what should be done today with the result of the war, namely with occupied territories. And if in stating this, I am incidentally doing my bit to foster unity, so much the better. One more caveat, and here I return to the first person plural. Since we are now venturing into highly sensitive territory, and especially since I heard that the Consulate General of Philadelphia is also sponsoring this talk, let me stress that our analysis pertains to the Soviet interest in, perception of, and response to Israel's nuclear program, not to the program's actual history, of which we have no independent information. However, we do believe that omitting the entire nuclear element from most discussions of the Six-Day War has meant the disregard of a factor which in the Cold War logic of the 1960s could not but have figured centrally in all the parties' considerations. Indeed, Egyptian documents that were captured in Sinai and published shortly after the war already identified the nuclear complex at Dimona as a major target for aerial bombardment. Still, most histories have either ignored or downplayed the nuclear issue as a cause of the crisis, even for Egypt, and the USSR is hardly mentioned at all in this context. We now know that an Egyptian airstrike at Dimona was one of two perceived threats that the Israeli leadership consistently worst feared in the run-up to the war. The other concern was direct Soviet military intervention. But both of these factors rarely, if ever, figured in post-war public or academic discourse about the war. We attribute this largely to the reticence of Israeli scholars on the nuclear issue, on the one hand, and on the other hand, to the successful Soviet cover-up of Moscow's failed initiative, a cover-up that, as Isabella pointed out, continues in the various post-Soviet republics, including Russia. For example, the general in command of the strategic bombers that were to strike Israeli targets, including Dimona, has stated that after the war's outbreak, he received oral orders to issue the target maps to the pilots, to strip the crews of identifying documents in case anyone was shot down, and to paint the planes in Egyptian markings. But, he added, he had a logistical problem. It was a Sunday, the paint factories were closed, and no one could find the guy with the key. Now that is a story that which for anyone with military or bureaucratic experience has the ring of truth. The only trouble with it is that the war began on a Monday, and famously went on for 6 days, so there were no Sundays at all in the six-day war. The paint incident, and therefore the order to prepare an airstrike on Israel, was therefore issued on the 4th of June, before the first Israeli shot was fired, but this fact is still rather clumsily being concealed. In fairness, as Isabella noted, similar cover-ups are still in effect in the United States and Israel as well. We have established, for example, that Israel did take Soviet prisoners of war on the Golan Heights, which Israel officially denies to this day. We can also state with certainty that the mission of the ill-fated USS Liberty was primarily to monitor Soviet communications. But the thick pack of documents on this aspect that the NSA provided in response to my Freedom of Information Act request was so heavily sanitized, including every mention of a Russian element, that I was even exempted from paying for the photocopying and the postage. In retrospect, there was plenty of indication that the Soviets and their allies treated the 1967 crisis as a nuclear-related matter of similar proportions to Cuba. To cite just a few instances, the Kremlin initiated the first use of the hotline to Washington that had been installed following the Cuban crisis. Romania, which after 1962 had concluded a secret agreement with the United States to prevent its being targeted if the next such crisis resulted in a superpower clash, evidently invoked this agreement in 1967 by refusing to sever relations with Israel along with the rest of the Warsaw Pact. And as we find in the book, this surprised the Soviets, who had not prepared for such a development. Getting back to those Soviet strategic bombers, their commander stated that their main targets were objectives protected by Israel's U.S.-made Hawk anti-aircraft missiles. The only installation that was so defended in 1967 was Dimona. This was one of many thinly disguised references that we found after our interest in the nuclear issue was ignited by a remarkable memorandum. This paper was included, almost certainly by oversight, in a recently published collection of Soviet Foreign Ministry documents. The paper is dated February 1966, and it relates how several weeks earlier, Isser Harel, the former Mossad chief, who was then an advisor to Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, relayed a message via the leader of Israel's Communist Party to the Soviet embassy in Tel Aviv. The message was that, despite its official ambiguity, Israel was bent on developing and procuring nuclear weapons. Now, we devote an entire chapter to a wide variety of possible motives for Harel's extraordinary move. But what matters is that the Soviets did take his message as both genuine and officially sanctioned, and they acted upon it as a grave threat to Soviet interests in the Middle East and even to the USSR's own security. During the 1956 Sinai-Suez crisis, a Soviet nuclear threat directed at Israel, Britain, and France sufficed, at least in Moscow's perception, to halt their offensive against Egypt. And so 1956 remained for the Soviets a successful example of how they could employ their nuclear clout in order to limit Israeli action against their Arab clients. But this held only so long as Israel had no counter-deterrent. Besides, in Moscow, there evidently was some real as well as feigned anxiety over a direct nuclear threat to its own southern regions. By 1965, the Soviets were certainly aware of Israel's nuclear project itself, which had been a top priority for its spies in Israel for several years. It is far less certain whether the Soviets had precise information as to the stage that Israel's development had reached. Therefore, when the Soviets received an unambiguous message from an authoritative Israeli source that Israel had decided, after much hesitation, to go ahead with developing an atomic bomb and intended to arm itself with such a weapon, the main news for Moscow must have been the fact that this goal had not yet been consummated and that a window of opportunity still existed to prevent its fruition. If this sounds somewhat familiar to you, well, it thus confronted the USSR with a dilemma not unlike the one that Washington is now facing vis-a-vis Iran. For lack of time, I can only refer you to the book itself for the spurt of Soviet counteraction that immediately followed Harel's disclosure. It began with diplomatic efforts to dissuade Israel, but within a few months it abruptly shifted to military preparations. Besides the joint war plan that was elaborated by the two defense chiefs, these preparations included providing a nuclear guarantee for Egypt instead of supplying that country with countervailing nuclear weapons. One of the first elements of the Soviet intervention to be implemented early in 1967 was the insertion of nuclear missile submarines and also some tactical nuclear weapons on surface craft into the Mediterranean and later into the Red Sea, with orders to fire them on a prearranged code signal if, among other contingencies, Israel did explode a nuclear device, which there was increasing evidence that by this point it was on the verge of completing. But as I have already mentioned, the Soviets also prepared to assist in a conventional strike at the Israeli nuclear project. There have been some misstatements of our case in the book. We do not claim the Soviets were preparing a nuclear first strike at Israel. So please, if you read that, that's not what we're saying. I will skip any more details of these Soviet actions in order to focus on the single case that both exemplifies our research methodology and also ties together all the strands of our thesis, in addition to explaining how the word foxbats got into the title. It also provided us with the most gratifying instance of conclusive official corroboration after the manuscript was completed, so that here I'm telling you something you cannot read in the book. It's worth coming. I refer to the two reconnaissance flights that passed over Dimona on the 17th and the 26th of May, 1967. As we know today from both Israeli and United States documents, these flights caused such consternation in the Israeli leadership that they were a major catalyst for its decision to go to war, since neither Israel's warplanes nor those Hawk missiles managed to intercept the intruders. No official version was ever published about these overflights. The details emerged over the years in a bewildering variety of versions as to the number, path, and behavior of the hostile aircraft, which, while described as mysterious, are also identified as, quote, apparently, unquote, Egyptian MiG-21s. Now, we have often compared our entire research to a 10,000-piece puzzle, of which 5 random pieces arrive in the mail every week. In the case of the Dimona overflights, however, our progress was more like a detective novel, as we were lucky enough for the evidence to present itself in sequence that permitted some linear deduction. I'd like to emphasize, however, that the use of this criminal simile is not by way of attaching any value judgment. We're treating this as a detective case in the sense that this is how we arrived at the conclusion, not in the sense of an anti-Soviet diatribe. Well, this detective work began from the equivalent of a suspicious alibi. The performance of the MiG-21 was so similar to that of Israel's top fighter, the Mirage 3C, that the latter's failure even to engage the intruders seemed highly unlikely. Highly unlikely, of course, is in itself no proof to the contrary, but it led to the question, if not MiG-21s, what were those planes? Here we could extrapolate from other instances. In 1971-72, Soviet pilots did carry out all of the reconnaissance sorties over Sinai and over Israel proper that were needed in order to prepare Egypt's cross-canal offensive in 1973. They flew the still experimental MiG-25, which was dubbed by NATO the Foxbat, which even then far outdid any Western fighter for speed and altitude, and then too, Israel could do absolutely nothing about it. Could the Soviets have done the same as early as 67? Western observers were first given a glimpse of the MiG-25 on the 9th of July, 1967, at an air show near Moscow, a date that now seemed to us less than coincidental. We soon discovered circumstantial evidence, statements in the Russian aviation literature, that the plane's prototypes, which had been setting records since 1964, were tested operationally in the Arab-Israeli arena in the late 1960s. Indeed, one reconnaissance variant of the model was developed specifically for the Middle Eastern's purpose. Once we knew what to look for, it was quite easy to find several testimonies that were given from 1993 on by General Alexander Vibonov, a hero of the Soviet Union for shooting down 28 Nazi warplanes in World War II, who therefore had little reason to fabricate this further detail for his own glorification. He reiterated on a number of occasions, and recently insisted on this version when he was approached in Moscow, that in 1967 he flew a dozen operational sorties out of Egypt. Two of these flights, he said, were in a MiG-25 over Israel, and they were so sensitive that the defense minister himself in Moscow had to approve each one separately. In fact, Vibornov repeated the story here in the United States when he was invited to attend the annual gathering of eagles at Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama. And this prime piece of evidence in English has waited unnoticed on an official U.S. Air Force website since 1999. You can look for it. He even added there the equally sensational statement that he was sent to Egypt in order to command a putative air intervention in favor of the Arabs against Israel, and that he witnessed the Israeli bombing of an Egyptian airbase. That is, Vibornov's mission preceded the war, and its post-dating after the war, in a Russian magazine version, is again a ham-handed cover-up attempt. Checking back against even the most detailed Israeli versions to date, we found out that there was nothing to refute the participation of at least one MiG-25 in each of these incidents. In each case, at least one intruder had outrun the interceptors, unseen and unidentified. Indeed, even had visual contact been made, no Israeli pilot yet had any idea that this model even existed, let alone what it looked like. And so misidentification would have been quite natural. Now that we had this material witness, General Vibornov, we felt that we could issue an indictment. That is, the paper that led the editorial director of Yale University Press, Jonathan Brent, to envisage this book and offer us the contract. He and other Cold War specialists, Mr. Brent has been the editor of a series, Annals of Communism, and he is a very knowledgeable person on the USSR. Well, he and other Cold War specialists understood that even without the other evidence that we had assembled, the very fact that the USSR committed its own top pilots and aircraft at the height of the 1967 crisis, for the most provocative gesture conceivable over Israel's most guarded target, was enough to dispose of the orthodoxy about Moscow's inadvertent blunder into the war and its supposed attempt to defuse the crisis. This is especially true of the second flight. This flight on May 26th took place while the Egyptian Minister of War was in Moscow, poring with his Soviet counterpart over those maps that I mentioned before, and begging for clearance to strike first, instead of waiting for Israel's first strike, as the joint plan with the Soviets had envisaged. And he was, of course, absolutely right from the Egyptians' point of view, as the actual events proved. But the Soviets prevailed on him, and through him on Nasser, to hold back until Israel did strike first, lest they, the Egyptians, be branded the aggressors, which would bar the Soviets from aiding them. At this juncture, the second Foxbat flight was clearly meant to show that the Soviets were in earnest, and to ensure, successfully enough, that Israel was scared into action. The Foxbat case thus united all the components: intentional Soviet precipitation of the war, direct military intervention, the centrality of the nuclear issue, and the targeting of Israel's nuclear program. Now, although Viborno's testimony had never been officially confirmed, we rested our case in the form of this book, quite confident that we had secured a conviction. But while the jury was out, we were handed the stunning bonus of a signed confession. As so often occurred in our research, the most telling details emerged parenthetically in a document that was composed for an entirely different purpose. This was an article signed by the chief spokesman of the Russian Air Force and posted on the Russian Defense Ministry's official website, which is about as official as you can get. It was written, of all things, to mark the anniversary of the Russian Air Force's School for Test Pilots. But it happened to list among the graduate achievements one Alexander Bezhevets, then a colonel and now a general, who before the Six-Day War in 1967 carried out two, quote, unique, unquote, flights over Israel in a MiG-25. So we believe, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that your only verdict can now be guilty as charged. And if all the rest of our evidence is added to the dossier, the reappraisal of Cold War history, not to mention Middle Eastern annals, must now begin. But you must be asking, why did most of this Soviet intervention never take place? One hardly needs to tell an American audience 4 years into the Iraq War how even the best laid plans of a superpower can go horribly wrong, and for what perennially recurring reasons. The Soviets correctly predicted not only that the Israelis would be drawn into striking first, and that the United States would consequently, as it had warned, declare neutrality and withdraw its fleet from the Eastern Mediterranean. They even knew or figured out the date of the Israeli strike. But as at many other points in this narrative, their Russian-scale concepts were completely out of line with Middle Eastern reality. As we saw, the Egyptians read the situation much better. When they contemplated an Israeli offensive, what the Russians eventually evidently had in mind was a World War II-style land offensive across a broad front. They did not foresee the character, and especially the devastating effect, of Israel's strike at Arab air bases, which, among other results, made their use by Soviet planes impossible, and without air superiority, the calculated risk of a confrontation with the United States became such that the original plan became intolerable. Egypt's belated acknowledgement that its plight was desperate also contributed to the Politburo's 5 days of dithering whether to go ahead with the action as planned at any price or not. On the sixth day, what was planned as a surprise operation was activated openly when it seemed to the Soviets that there was a considerable risk that Israel would not only take the Golan Heights, but also capture Damascus and topple the pro-Soviet Syrian regime. So this time, what was before a surprise operation was activated openly, this time as a deterrent threat over the hotline, and with some success. The Soviet landing force was sent in toward its planned bridgeheads, but within 2 hours, Israel stopped dragging its feet on a ceasefire in the Golan Heights, and the operation could be aborted. So we've been able here to present, in a very abridged form, only a handful out of the numerous exhibits that make up our case. We'll gladly respond to any questions now, but even that can hardly do justice to 304 pages, which, if we do say so ourselves, are short on theory and long on factual detail. If this 40-year-old but still enigmatic issue intrigues you as irresistibly as it did us, please take the trouble to wade through all those 300 pages before you accept or reject it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I should first add that the 304 pages are available in the back of the room, and the authors are available to sign the book, so please feel free to avail yourself of this opportunity. I'd like to thank both of you, Gideon and Isabella, for your clear presentation of what I think everyone will agree is a remarkable piece of historical detective work. The reinterpretation of a mystery that is now 40 years old, a major mystery, is truly an accomplishment. And we're grateful to you for the work you've done. Let me start by asking the first question, which is, what do you think that initial little tidbit that got that piqued your interest would have been about? What would a so-called volunteer force of Soviets, volunteering for the Egyptians, what would they have done? What they had liaison in mind to the Israeli Arabs? If the state of Israel was to be destroyed, what do you imagine the Soviets had in mind? A Palestinian regime of some sort, the extension of Egyptian power? Any clues about that?
I think instead of climbing up and down, I'll invite Isabella to take a seat here too.
Well, what if questions are very dangerous. Our colleague Tom Seger wrote in the New York Times yesterday that serious historians don't engage in them, the journalists may. Since we presume to have graduated from journalist to historian, I can perhaps exempt myself from making a full answer to that. But what we do know, what we have assembled of the landing operation alone, is that the volunteers were from among the regular seamen on some 30, perhaps more, Soviet warships that were in the Eastern Mediterranean. We have the actual testimonies from four or five of them separately. We know, as Isabella said, from Moscow officials that the order to assemble these parties was actually given. And what's even more interesting, when Isabella first published in Russian our initial findings in a Russian academic journal, without telling us, they asked for a member of the Soviet, the Russian Academy of Sciences, to write a postscript. This gentleman, Professor Kislov, was at the time a Soviet correspondent in the Middle East, and he said, from eyewitness accounts, what's all this talk about untrained seamen being raised as volunteers? There were regular Marines there, a whole battalion of them. They were prepared both physically and psychologically. This is one of several testimonies that we have, but that's a very authoritative one, that also a battalion of regular Marines was involved, perhaps more than one battalion. This altogether accounts for about 2,000 men. Now, what could 2,000 men have accomplished? Isabella remembers from the home front, and I remember from the front in 67. Just about every able-bodied man in Israel was called up. High school students were delivering the mail and manning the grocery stores, and superannuated veterans were on civil defense. Small landing forces along the coast could have caused such disruption, such demoralization, and pinned down enough forces to seriously hinder the Israeli war effort. In addition, it would be softening up from the rear for an Egyptian operation that was planned to come overland along the coast. In addition, there's a fascinating detail in the attack plan for Syria that was elaborated with Soviet advisors. We know of their involvement simply because some of the documents are in Russia. And it included the detail that after breaking through northern Israel, this Syrian force was to link up with a supposedly Egyptian naval landing force north of Haifa. There's no evidence that Egypt was capable of or was contemplating such a naval operation, but we do know now from several sources that several of these Soviet landing parties were to land in or near Haifa. So this all links up into a unified plan. About the Israeli Arabs, we can only infer from the testimonies that we have from the military interpreters that Isabella mentioned, who were put on alert in Alexandria to be put on board the ships and to go in with the landing forces. They were told, the Israeli Arabs are waiting for us.
I'm not so sure they actually were. The Israeli Arabs kept the peace quite admirably, both in 67 and in 73. This corresponds with testimonies that Israeli communists receive, and as you probably know, many of Israel's communists, and now nearly all of Israel's communists, are Arab, that Soviet forces would be there to protect them. When the war went against Israel, which, as they were told by Soviets here in Israel, among other occasions, on the VE Day celebrations on May 9th, that is, before the crisis openly erupted. So that there's overwhelming evidence, we think. We're never going to find, because we doubt that one ever was written, a plan on Politburo letterhead saying, well, this is what we're going to do. In most cases, as I mentioned in the case of the general commanding the strategic bombers, we have many, many cases from parallel sources, unrelated sources, that orders were issued orally down the chain of command, so that no military document exists. But the overwhelming evidence we have from so many sources is that this Russian operation was contemplated. Now, what they actually wanted to achieve, Isabella addressed that in her book. You want to go back to what the Soviet war aims were? You actually so you want to just recap it briefly?
Well, what we think, according to the evidence we have, that one of the main political goals of the Soviet Union was to press Israel to agree to reduce itself to the partition borders and to accept all the Palestinian refugees inside of those borders, which actually would mean elimination of the State of Israel. This is one of the main political goals.
Plus to accept the elimination of
the... Oh, yes, and of course this would entail the agreement to destroy the Dimona nuclear facility.
We have 15 minutes for questions.
Assuming that you have read Seymour Hersh's expose of the motive, would you please comment
the on the sensible option? You mean the book, The Sensible Option?
Yes.
We not only have read it, we quote it. Seymour Hersh has very interestingly, but unfortunately, without any attribution, posited the cause for what we find is the Soviets' apprehension of Israel's nuclear capability. He says that from the outset, the Israeli nuclear project was aimed more at deterrence toward the Soviet Union than toward the Arabs, and that the original plan was to inform the Soviet Union once Israel had a nuclear weapon, so as to deter the Soviet Union from any further attempt, which it did once or twice, to blackmail Israel by threatening a nuclear intervention. And he goes on to claim that this actually took place, that this information was passed to the Soviets after the 1967 war, when under Dayan's orders as Minister of Defense. So we find that such a message was actually transmitted to the Soviets much earlier, and in a very strange way, because it was given in the future tense. Anyone who knows the slightest thing about deterrence knows you can't deter anyone with a weapon you don't have. You can try to deter him with a weapon, to make believe that you have the weapon, and to deny it and try your best to make the rest of the world think you're lying. But by telling the Soviets, we are going to do it, we are going to procure it, we are going to deploy it, that's hardly a way to deter them. That's inviting them to strike it and prevent it. And so we go into quite a range of variations as to why Yisr Harel, Mr. Security, would have done such a thing. But the fact remains, whatever his motive may have been, the Soviets took it at face value and acted accordingly. So in this respect at least, I'm not going to offer a blanket endorsement of Hersh's book, but in this respect at least, the two, his work and ours, seem definitely to conform, yes.
I assume by denying that you have nuclear weapons in the effort to make convince people that you actually have them, you're referring to Saddam Hussein.
Yeah. No, not necessarily.
So you refer to the different superpower relationship that existed in 1967 from what evolved after that. Can you comment what role, and my recollection and understanding is that France was actually a primary supplier of Israel before and maybe during the Six-Day War. Can you comment where France fits in any of this?
The Israeli army has been built on mostly on the French arms. But in 65-66, some first agreements with the United States on supply of Skyhawks and some other tanks through Western Germany have been reached. And in 67, actually, according to the very good book by Ami Gluska, Israeli army was at its lowest point because it was just before the replacing old, outdated European weaponry with the new American arms. So you can imagine that in this situation, nobody takes care of the arms of maintenance and the replacement parts and so on. This is another point pointing to the direction that Israel wouldn't be even interested of initiating the war when its army is at such a stage.
Let me also add something about the nuclear issue here. As I mentioned briefly, the success of the Soviet nuclear threat in 1956, Britain already had its own nuclear weapons, but France and Israel did not, and was definitely a very strong impetus for both of these countries to start developing, in many respects jointly, a nuclear program. The fact that de Gaulle came to power and the relationship cooled, still left Israel pretty much in the same position as France in this respect. But as Isabella mentioned, the cooling off of the relationship with France and the gradual warming with the United States had already begun to move Israel. As you know, in a ship, it takes a while from when you turn the wheel to when the rudder actually turns you around. The United States did not yet have the kind of firm commitment to Israel's security as it has today. And Israel was repeatedly warned by the United States, and Judith and I were arguing this over dinner last night, to what extent the United States really signaled Israel that it could go to war or to strike first. I believe, though this can be argued, that the signals from the United States were unambiguously no. And the best proof of that is that when the United States was accused by the Egyptians of assisting in the Israeli first strike, the Sixth Fleet steamed away from the Eastern Mediterranean and left it entirely to the free run of the Soviet ship. We thought there were 30 Soviet ships here, according to the Soviet veterans' testimonies. When we asked the commander of Israeli signal intelligence at the time, can you confirm that you actually received signals from 30 Soviet surface ships? He said, why 30? I counted 43. So the relationship was still definitely asymmetrical. In retrospect, I think the United States here took more credit for standing up for Israel's security than it actually did at the time. What would have happened if it had really come to the worst, again, is an what-if question that's anyone's guess.
I'll just point out to you that what-if questions are very reputable among historians. There's a whole field now of counter-history. What if, what if? So you're in good standing. Final question, Harmon?
I know you want to stick with history and not come up with contemporary speculation, maybe, whether the book journalist started. This morning in August is a story that the general staff was very concerned about a strike from Syria. The Syrians have been on the Atlantic tank weapons, apparently is an building and with new missiles. And the but the story, the reason that the Russians would now be interested in such a strike would simply be it will help keep the price of oil up. Last summer during the oil attack, the price of oil was 77. Russian economy is pretty hopeless without a high price of oil. So when it also has a coherent story about the war in Russia, would be interested in this situation. In temporary relevance, though, we could see this earlier.
I have even a better excuse than a what-if question for that. The question was what our reading was of the present situation with Syria and Russia vis-a-vis Israeli apprehensions, as reported in Haaretz, of a Syrian attempt to provoke a war with Israel. Am I getting it right? Utilizing some superiority they have in anti-tank weapons.
Impact on oil.
And the impact on oil, which for Russia, is now very higher oil prices are good for Russia. I have a better excuse, I said, than an as if, what if question. Exactly 9 months ago, we were offered a book contract by Yale University Press. We went home. In order to get the book out in time for the anniversary of the Six-Day War, we went home, locked ourselves in, and worked around the clock. Since then, I turned down every request I had for commentary on current affairs simply because I had no time to follow the news. So that you probably know much more about this right now than I do. We've been begging off questions on recent current events simply because we have not been following them. The only exception we made from this self-imposed hermitage that we had was to drive our kids to school and back. Other than that, the radio was off, television was off, and we have to beg off on that question.
Let's try one more quickly.
We don't hit.
Is that a mic?
You mentioned an Israeli cover-up. Let me also add, you mentioned an American cover-up.
Yes.
Could you explain why?
I wish I could. The Israeli example I gave, actually there were two Israeli examples. One is, Israel has never given an official version for those overflights of Dimona. And even though when we approached an Israeli intelligence officer who was in charge of Soviet affairs after the 67 war, to be precise, and said very gingerly, well, what do you think of our MiG-25 hypothesis? And he said, well, of course there were MiG-25s. There had been MiG-21s. We would have shut them down. So that apparently Israel, if not at the actual time, may be inferred backwards from the appearance of the MiG-25s in 1971-72 that indeed that's what they were, but it has never been published. In fact, no official version of these flights has ever been published, and on the Israeli Air Force's official website there are two conflicting versions. The other one is the matter of the Soviet prisoners of war. Now, in both of those cases, I'm very hard put to suggest a good reason for continuing, I wouldn't call it cover-up, but blackout. There was blackout on this. In respect of the U.S., there's another few examples. For instance, in the volume of foreign relations of the United States on the Six-Day War period, which was published 3 years ago, there's a very remarkable case on that day, May 26th, where the editors had documents that they thought were important enough to include, but the documents themselves are totally sanitized. So you have only the date of a document, and in one case, not even from who it is to who it is. But there is a document. No, it's really a kind of a teaser. Why? I can only suggest, you know, usually when you have a conspiracy theory and an ineptitude theory, go for the ineptitude. I would suggest that this is more bureaucratic inertia than ineptitude. That once something is kept secret, then letting it go is difficult, and over time, it becomes more embarrassing to explain why you kept it secret than the actual event itself would have been. But that's about as far as I can go. What possible security implications there could be now for the Soviet-oriented aspect of the Liberties mission, I simply cannot imagine. But the fact is that it's still being blacked out.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank you both for your wonderful presentation. And I thank you all for joining us at lunch today. Hope again you will take advantage of the author's presence and the books for sale in the back. I look forward to seeing you at the next events of our many different organizations. Goodbye.